obsessed.
Whenever we start this, we don't ever really have like the intro song plays after I edit it, but usually I just cut in wherever. So likely I'll cut in right here and include all this. Welcome to the first, what the fuck did I call it? I can't remember. Xmas, Guestmas variety season, because I love a tongue twister.
Guestmas.
I definitely stole that. So credit to whoever that goes to. But yes, so this December, we're doing guest episodes. So I don't have Laura with me today. I have Tom.
How's it going, Ash?
Hi. This is weird because it's also, we're not in the same room.
Well, no, we're not. This is sort of my first, this is my first guest spot on a podcast as well. So
exciting.
Yeah, a bit of that creakiness from me in this, you know, that in the intense role as the podcast guest. This is good, though, that when I started my quest of content creation, I was just one of those things like, you know, God, all I want in life is for another podcast to describe me as a friend of the pod.
You are.
I feel like this is, at the very least, the step towards that for Dead Obsessed.
Yeah, for sure. So Tom and I actually met over Fringe, and our live Fringe show hasn't been released, won't be released for a while, but I did an interview for Tom's, what, can you explain it better than me, please?
Oh, it was just for my YouTube channel.
Yeah.
It was sort of combining the idea of like podcasts and streaming, just that, you know, I streamed a game and we, you know, we played Unrailed and we played it together, and
it was frustrating but great.
It was an interesting one. I haven't revisited it, but I might do it at some point. But yeah, we just played that and we talked about Dead Obsessed and the upcoming live show, or was upcoming for you then, and just some of the other stuff that you guys have been working on. So it was just more of like a chill hangout.
Yeah, it was really fun. But yeah, so Tom is our first ever guest on Dead Obsessed. How does that make you feel?
Exciting. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, no, this is hopefully it's the first of many. Let's see how many murder cases I can dig up.
It doesn't have to be murder, but I'm sure there's lots, because I have a never-ending list. So for Guestmas, what we're doing is the guests that come on the show, this is just for the listeners, the guests that come on the show are going to bring a story that is somehow sort of close to their heart, not necessarily like, it doesn't even have to be in a good way, they just have some sort of connection with it, something that they enjoy a lot, or, you know, whatever their connection is for that. And then I'm going to do something Christmas related, because my God, there's so many Christmas crimes out there.
No, I can imagine.
Jesus Christ.
when you asked me if I wanted to come on, that I sort of thought of just went for the first thing that came to mind, and mine isn't Christmas related, but it is seasonal. Mine's more around Easter. So,
oh, cool.
We pick different holidays.
Yeah, it's just all of the holidays. Just before we get into any of our stories, I have just a little housekeeping corner, shout out corner, I think it is. We reached 100 followers on Instagram, which for some people does not mean much, but to us it's really exciting as a new budding podcast. Like, what, this is episode 9 or something like that when this comes out. And our 100th follower on Instagram, oh my God, I'm going to apologize now. I don't know how to say your name. Kristen Tankersley. And when I asked her if there was anything she wanted us to promo or shout out, she's asked if we can give her friend Brandy a shout out. So Brandy's the one that told her about Dead Obsessed. She says, "We are the oddest pair of friends ever, but true crime obsessed. She's a vegan, I'm a hunter. We had polar opposite upbringings, but crime and paranormal podcasts brought us together." So that's really sweet. That's a really lovely friendship there. So thank you, Brandy, and thank you, Kristen, for joining the Instagram and being part of our little pod family.
Hey, yeah, Kristen, Brandy, Anya's.
That was the most really Australian saying ever.
that's really the biggest thing. One thing I noticed that the ABC podcasts were trying for a while, instead of saying, oh, rate and review, they were like, how about if you want to do something to help us out, tell a friend.
That's cute. Yeah, I like that. That's nice. That's really good. So with that out of the way, our thank yous, our introduction. So Tom, like I said before, we met over Fringe. We connected through that. Tom's a comedian. Like you said, he's got a YouTube channel. And what do you stream games and all
stream
sorts of
games,
different things?
I've got my Fringe show on there now. So
Oh, you did upload the live. I'll have to look at that.
Yeah, I don't think anyone really watched it during Fringe, and I didn't really expect them to. But
Digital Fringe was such a weird thing.
It was a bit of a mess. There was a lot of, you know, they made it very difficult on how to actually watch things for people.
Mm.
I watched another comedian do his show, and it became one of those awkward things where it turns out that I was the only one on the Google Hangouts call. So.
Oh, wow, private comedy show.
He went through his bits. I was doing my best to be the crowd, but the only upside was to it is it felt like I was back at Voltaire on a Friday night.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, we found that with Fringe it was really good for us because like it's usually just me and Laura in a room talking to each other anyway. So that's kind of all it was. Like we did have some interaction from the chat and that we did have a few people like in there chatting, but it's not like like audience interaction where you can see them and all that kind of thing. So it was a bit odd, but still wasn't too far from our normal, which was nice.
Yeah, but I guess it was just maybe nice to see that there was a chat and that people were in there and vibing with you as well.
Yeah, it was definitely an experience, which made us excited for next year as well. So that's something we're definitely going to look into. Okay, so Tom, tell me a story. You're going to go first. I think all of our guests this Guestmas are going to go first because my stories are all Christmas crimes. So that'll sort of tie it all into December and the seasonal holidays. So yeah, take it away. What's your story?
Yeah, so to select something that I have a bit of a local connection to, I wanted to tell the story of the murder of the teacher Stephanie Scott in Leeton back in 2015. I feel like I've got a little bit of intangible connection to it just because I was back visiting my family in Griffith around the time that it happened, which is Griffith is only 50 kilometres away from Leeton, which, you know, when you're talking about two rural towns, is only a half-hour drive.
And this is all in New South Wales in New South Wales, in Australia, for our international listeners.
Yes.
Yeah. And so it's kind of like your hometown.
Pretty much. Like it's what it is, I even know a woman who taught at the same school and knew Stephanie because
oh my God.
being so close, the two towns, that it was quite common for people to live in one town and actually commute over to the other for work.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And like we were back there and it was interesting seeing the story develop in real time and being over in Leeton that, you know, the news could still travel quite quickly to Griffith. And just that, yeah, it was one of those things. It was just weird because it didn't happen. And, you know, that sort of thing doesn't really happen in those areas. And just being so close to it. I'll get into the meat of the story and run through things because I've got everything here sort of plotted out kind of in chronological order, and I can give my own takes on some of the details of it as we go through it all.
Yeah, awesome.
So this all really started on the 5th of April in 2015. That's when there was social media posts and a bit of talk about a teacher in Leeton who had gone missing. This was a Stephanie Scott. Part of the why word was really getting around is that she'd gone missing over the Easter long weekend, and it was a week out from a wedding.
Yeah, so this story, actually, I remember 2015, I was like second year of uni, and I remember seeing this on all the social medias and all of the local news, and it was just the radio, everything. Everybody Australia-wide knew about her going missing. They were trying to find her.
Yeah, and that's really a big part of it, that there was this big social media campaign pretty much as soon as that she was reported as missing, that everyone, especially around like that Griffith Leeton area, were posting on social media, have you seen Stephanie, keep an eye out for her, her wedding's coming up, all that. So I was pretty much aware of this as it happened. And again, the being a week out from a wedding, you know, some people were like, oh, she's got cold feet, that she's just gotten scared. But you know, as her partner, Aaron Leeson Woolley, said that, you know, this was out of character for her, didn't see any reason why she would be scared. She'd been with him for 5 years. Everything seemed to be going quite well. So, yeah, it seemed really odd that she would disappear.
Also, like, if you're going to run away a week before your wedding, which people do, that's fine. You usually tell, like, your family or your maid of honour. Like, they're on your side, you know? Fair enough if you don't tell the person you're marrying because you're running away from them. But you tell your family, you tell your maid of honour, you tell somebody knows, you know?
Yeah, there would be someone that you tell. And so then it's that this really hit the news websites and that on the 7th of April. That's when word really got out. She'd been missing for 48 hours, and the search for Stephanie had begun. From there, they actually arrested someone quite quickly, and that was one of the cleaners at the school, and that was this guy by the name of Vincent Stanford. And I just, part of the reason I picked this is because, like, all the circumstances around it, you could not pick a more serial killer name for someone, I reckon.
Vincent Stanford. It sounds kind of regal to me, but in, like, you know how whenever you see, like, a movie with the, like, a royal family in it, there's always one dude that's just an absolute nightmare of a person. It's that dude.
Yeah. It's like, it would at the very least be, like, a twist villain name. But fuck. With a name like that, he's going to be the bad guy.
Yeah, for sure. It's like calling him, what, like Dr. Von Evil or something.
And I should send you a picture of this guy as well. Like, fuck.
I'll post it on the Instagram, yeah.
He was 24 at the time of the murder, but I swear to God, like, he was already, like, completely bald on top, just had, like, the hair around the sides near his ears and all that. Like, motherfucker looks like he was probably, like, 45. Yeah, he was pretty much one of the first and main suspects. He was arrested. The Griffith Local Area Commander, Superintendent Michael Rowan, confirmed that there was two main crime scenes, that being the school, and there was a car found on a property at Wamoon Village in the Leetonshire Council. There was also the crime scene, which was a residential property, which was where Vincent Stanford lived, and that Miss Scott was last seen at the school on Myrtle Street about 11 a.m. on Sunday. And now this was Easter Sunday as well. So a big part of it here is that she was at the school over the Easter long weekend doing some additional marking to clear things up before her honeymoon the week later. So
going the extra mile, yeah.
Yeah, and this guy here, Vincent Stanford, he was the cleaner at the school, which is, how he knew of her. But it'll turn up later that he wasn't supposed to be at the school at the time, but he kept hanging around it.
So he was just hanging out at the school for no apparent reason.
Well, we'll get into that. Okay. I have some details on Vincent, because he's a bit of an interesting character himself.
Bit of a trash bucket.
Yeah, Mrs. Scott was last seen at the school 11 a.m. Police said Stanford had been in the Leeton area for about 13 months. Neighbors living next to Stanford, it was a shock to wake and see that the house next door was a crime scene, one said. But when they spoke recently, Stanford discussed that he had a very heavy workload. He said that he was working about 120 hours a week, which... It seems like he said it's because they were short a person at his work, but he was a school cleaner. I don't know if he cleaned some other facilities as well, but
kids are really fucking messy.
I ran the maths on this. He's either working almost like 20 hours a day Monday to Friday, or pretty much 18-hour days 7 days a week.
Yeah, that seems like a bit of a stretch.
As a cleaner. So that doesn't...
Was he a gardener or a maintenance man as well? Because that might explain a little bit of extra time.
No.
But also, it's not a huge town, is it?
No, it's not. So I don't see how there would be that many facilities to clean. And there's nothing that couldn't just wait to be done every second week. It's probably just a good cover for all the other weird shit he was up to.
Oh, great.
Now, the police arrested him, had some crime scenes. They were keen to speak to anyone who may have seen an older white Toyota Hilux with a canopy over the back traveling around Leeton.
Every car in Australia.
Yeah, unfortunately. And the problem here is that they had a prime suspect, but now they had to find the body. So the search was on from there, because they had Vincent. He was seemed very much like the likely person to have done it. But now they had to figure out where Stephanie was. And this is where we start getting into things a bit more. The investigators discovered a woman's body in bushland about 70 kilometres northeast of the town on Friday, 5 days after she was reported missing.
Jesus.
Yeah, the body was discovered by police on motorbikes about 5 metres away from a roadway in Kopara National Park. There was attempted burning of the body. It was just... Yeah, really, really unfortunate. And just
also, he tried to cover it up.
Yeah, tried to hide the evidence.
Burning a body never works.
No. I can't see how, like, we're what, like 70% water or something? That...
I won't go into it now, but you'll find out later some facts about trying to burn evidence.
All right. But yeah, that was in Kokopara National Park, which is just a big, really, it's just a big area of bushland that even sort of borders Griffith as well. So it's just this big area of bushland, kind of just out in the sort of middle of nowhere. And so he's taken a long trip up there to try to hide the evidence. But yeah, since there was such a massive search on for Stephanie, that they eventually found her. One thing that
it's that crazy I think, that I wonder what the chances were like of actually finding her if it's such a big area. Like, that's got to be incredibly lucky, or he's incredibly stupid and it was like by an entrance.
Well, yeah, as it said here, they discovered the body about 5 meters from a roadway in Cochrane.
Oh, okay, so he's an idiot.
So yeah, that he drove 70 kilometers away to try and hide it, but then unfortunately only hit her about 5 meters off the road.
Oh my god!
From where you could just park a car.
Wow, that's a I don't know if that's just stupidity or if that's just lazy. Like, he'd done all the driving and he was like, oh, I can't be fucked. Like, I'll just, he is good enough.
Yeah, I think he probably just thought that the driving was enough and not that, oh, if there's a road, pretty much, you know, a fucking thoroughfare nearby, you know, made for people to easily pass down.
Police talk to each other in 2015, bud.
Yeah, and especially when that is the sort of place that you would try to hide a body, the police probably are going to end up there. And 5 meters off the road isn't all that far when you're on motorbikes.
Can you imagine if he was like sort of, you know how people sort of overthink things, but if he did it in a way that was like, I don't think he did this, but I just think it would be funny if he thought like, oh, they'll never look this close to a road. Nobody's that stupid. Nobody will find her.
I reckon that could have always happened. Sometimes these people, they have a bit of that superiority complex where they think they're smarter than everybody else.
Yeah.
And look, there's one thing here I came across as well that I just wanted to read out, that that Stephanie's sister, Kim, she published a poem that she'd written for the couple's wedding. So I'll just read this one. They met in Canowindra, young and sweet, flirting at IGA between the creamy pasta salad and the cold meat. Twilight soccer was where it was at. Cara played host. The competition was fat. Stephanie and Aaron made a good team, a match made in heaven, so it would seem. Yeah,
that's not like real.
I think that is. It's got a link here.
Oh Jesus Christ! Like,
I feel like it's
I'm sorry. If somebody read that at my wedding, I would not invite them to anything ever again.
I think the cheesiness gives it authenticity.
Oh, but wow!
You know it's coming from the heart.
IGA, for international listeners, IGA is like a really crappy, usually an old independent grocery store. In Melbourne, some of them are a bit nicer, but where I'm from in WA, regionally, they're really small, dingy, like corner store, milk bar kind of grocery stores that just everything is like off-brand and not the highest quality, and they all employ like only 13, 14 year olds. IGA was actually my first job.
Like the black and gold everything.
Yes! Home brand. Oh.
Thanks. There was one in Griffith, and that was really survived by its deli section. It seems like the IGAs, you sort of have to buy all the supermarket stuff, but you're given a bit more flexibility there, and that's what really kept it going.
Wow, what a poem.
So, yeah, from here.
I mean, she was a grade school teacher. She probably would have liked it.
I think so. I think, you know, coming like from your sister on your wedding day, emotions are high anyway. You can probably get away with a lot of stuff.
Yeah, true.
But yeah, here's some other details about Vincent Stanford, just the most like typical murderer, really, I guess, that you could come up with.
Trash pile time.
Yep, here we go. And some of this also is taken from this like Sydney Morning Herald exclusive, trying to make it like this big scoop that, oh, what do you know, he sat in his room all day and played video games. And it's like, yes, that's every 24-year-old.
That's ever. Me. Hello.
So it says here that, but Mr. Stanford maintained a secret online life, hiding behind fantasy characters to indulge in his obsession with computer games, violent videos, and neo-Nazi propaganda.
Neo-Nazi propaganda?
Yeah, so...
In video games, or did he actually just have it in his room?
Yeah, this is, it says here, Vincent Stanford liked clips of Nazi marching songs and other Third Reich military music.
That's a weird, that, I don't even know how to explain that. That's not normal. Even for Nazis.
No, well, here's another one there in that area. In a video about Nazi leader Rudolf Hess, he posted, R.I.P. Rudolf Hess, Ich berue nix, which translates as, I regret nothing. So.
Okay.
That's when you've put a real bit of effort into your neo-Nazism, and you're not just that's like beyond being edgy.
I really wish that he'd just used like Google Translate for that and gotten it a bit wrong.
Unfortunately not. I studied German at high school, and that seems grammatically correct.
I can say Ich bin ein Banana. You're welcome.
But and he just seems like an interesting character. That his twin brother, who I'll get into as well, because as a true crime enthusiast, Ash, I'm sure you know that twins are just fucking weird. Mr. Stanford was born in Tasmania and lived in the Netherlands for a decade. He was raised in Tasmania by his parents, Annika and Steve, until they moved them over to the Netherlands. And then soon after they moved, Steve, his father, left them and returned to Australia and had no further contact with his children. The three boys were raised by their mother in the Netherlands, and evidence tendered to the court suggested a normal childhood. He had a few additional problems with rage and anger. There was a bit of an unverified case of him getting aggressive with a teacher in the Netherlands and being suspended for a while. It says here in all the stuff that I read that there's no evidence to indicate there was any adverse or dysfunctional circumstances in his upbringing. But one thing that I just heard from more local talk around the area this was a bit of a weird family, and that one thing that you could probably check off the serial killer list is having a bit of like an overbearing or dominant mother or a female figure in his life.
Yeah, there's usually some sort of like childhood trauma in there.
Another thing that just strikes me as interesting is before the murder happened, that the family had been living in Leeton for about 14 months, and a lot of the talk from people around was saying that hardly anyone knew him.
He was new around town.
Or just a small town like that when you've been living there for over a year, to have so few people know who you are, and also working in what I would almost regard as a semi-public role, as especially a school cleaner, that it really would have to be that if he's not working, that he's just at home in his room.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, here's just another interesting note that I want to bring up as we slowly expand into talking about his brother. That before working as a cleaner, Mr. Stanford did work for his identical twin brother, Marcus, who was part of an Australian-based independent computer game company, Bulletproof Studio.
Dope.
That Vincent was listed as a designer and Marcus as an animator on the never-released shoot-em-up arcade game Overseer. One of the company's founders said that Mr. Stanford never actually worked for the firm, but did contribute on some of the projects.
Oh, that's weird.
I think it was more of an honorary thing that probably he and his brother wanted to make a video game at some point, and they just set up enough that they could put that on their LinkedIn profiles. And look, the impression that you get here as well is that, this says here that his brother worked for an independent video game company here. So you might think that, Marcus, good son, Vincent, bad son, but I don't think that was quite the case either. We'll get into that. He worked as a cleaner, and he worked at the school. He was able to pass all his checks. Of course, it's one of those things that, unfortunately, a lot of these people, they fantasize about a lot of stuff. They probably do a lot of weird shit behind closed doors, and they never actually do anything wrong, which would prevent them from getting something like a working with children's check. Then when they finally do something, it's like this, and it's such a big thing that, of course, he's never gonna work or do anything again. So it's fortunately one of those things where it's like, it's just a real like breaking point of when something does happen.
Do we know what his snapping point was?
It was just this, he doesn't explain it, but I reckon there's
he never explained what happened.
No, There's some details here of what I think can play into and explain why it happened. It's just I wanted to include these details about him working as the school cleaner because that contract was actually through the same company that my brother worked for at the time. Completely different to departments and areas, but yeah, it's just one of those things where it's just like fuck that, you know, especially for someone like my brother that ends up that, you know, not all that far removed from this guy himself.
Yeah.
So here's more of the trash fire corner about Vincent so in the case there was four volumes of evidence tendered to court for Marcus, his brother, 16 volumes of evidence for Vincent. Among the evidence tendered against Vincent was the email purchases for Viagra. This is for a 24-year-old. I don't see why a 24-year-old would need Viagra. Cleaning products, a training sword, a knife, plastic handcuffs known as flexi cuffs, as well as an email inquiry about leg cuffs. That the invoice for Viagra was tendered alongside with pornography and dating site URLs. That those are conversations between himself and his brother on Facebook and phone conversations.
Did you say a training sword?
Yes, a training sword.
What does that even mean?
The only thing I can think of, and it doesn't make sense, is either it's like some hokey sort of like prop sword, or it makes even less sense. I know that in some martial arts, you can get like a bamboo sword with the bit of taut string through the middle of it, so when you hit against stuff, it makes a louder bang. But it's like, why would you need that if you're playing?
That was just like people who bought this also bought, and he just added it to his cart.
And maybe he thought that if I keep it in its sheath, no one can tell it's not actually a katana.
Yeah, if I keep it hidden, no one will know it's fake.
Yeah, and then here's some other stuff. I feel like maybe this should just go with a bit of a content warning here. There are going to be some heavy tags of stuff that he looked up. But the search history on Stanford's computer shows a history of seeking out and viewing violent rape scenes, some of them directed towards teachers. Examples of searches conducted by Stanford only weeks before the murder paint a disturbing picture. The search terms included items like bride rape, bride kidnapping, virgin bride brutally raped. You know.
So he like specifically, it wasn't necessarily like a fascination with Stephanie herself. It was just the fact that she was getting married and she was a teacher.
I think that definitely played into it. Because
wow.
Here's another part of, let me just find it in my notes here. Another part of what played into things is that he was just seen to be hanging around, especially the school after hours and especially near the female toilets. That he was just an odd character. He was seemed to be, when he wasn't working or in his room.
He just seems like a creepy pile of trash all around.
Yeah, be like following women around, taking, says he had thousands of photos of women there in Leeton and keeping notes on their movements and their routines. So it says here that when he finally did commit the murder, that there was just something in his brain saying that he had to do it and that apparently it wasn't premeditated. But it sort of comes across more like he may not have planned to do it, but he probably had enough notes on Stephanie's routine as well as, you know, a lot of other women in the area to sort of know when the time was right. But you have to remember this was Easter Sunday. The school was closed. So, you know, that they could have almost been the two people there at the school at the time. That he knew enough about what was going on to know an opportunity when he saw it.
I've just looked at a picture of him and he looks like a big toe.
Yeah, that's probably a good way to describe it. If you're wearing like new work socks and you just take them off and you look at your big toe and it's got like all the little black fluffy bits on it all over.
Yeah.
That's him.
He looks like a fluffy big toe.
Yeah, Vincent quite obviously did it. It was him. And then he got his twin brother involved, which at the time I thought that his twin brother was living with him and that he got drawn in as like a co-conspirator. Good thing I did my research here, because it turns out that Marcus Stanford was at his home in Forreston, South Australia. As I mentioned before, that sounded like he was a good son working at a game studio. No, it says here that South Australia police said Stanford, he works at a flower farm I would remain their custody until 7 a.m.
So that's nice. I've just found a picture as well. I'm just looking at images while we're talking. And, like, there's a picture of the twin brother and the dad. And he doesn't look half as sinister as his identical twin.
He looks a bit... He has a bit more of a softness about him, doesn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, I think it's just because, like, in the images, he's, like, smiling and he just is... you know, looking at the camera and just a bit more of like a relaxed, more open sort of presence about him than the other one that looks like a grumpy toe.
These notes I have here might change your opinion on him, because it says that after the murder, Vincent collected some of Stephanie's personal items, like her license, some other ID, and her engagement ring, and he mailed it to his brother up in South Australia. And that it says that Marcus Stanford told the police he kept the envelope in his room and only opened it about a week after his brother's arrest. This was a highly publicized case. Everybody would have known the circumstances of Vincent Stanford's arrest. Marcus would have known exactly why those items were mailed to him. But then it says here that Marcus Stanford admitted to selling the teacher's engagement ring and a ring a mother gave her for a graduation for just over $700.
Mm.
So he pawned a property and was, I think, planning to use that to buy like a plane ticket to go see his brother. But it's just by that point that you would have known that what your brother sent you was evident.
Maybe he was just really hoping that he was wrong and he was in denial about it.
Well, it says here that he told police he felt confused and angry about receiving Miss Scott's belonging. But when his brother asked him to sell the rings, Marcus Stanford said he complied out of misplaced loyalty.
Yeah. People do some weird shit for family sometimes, especially if they're like your identical twin.
There's probably a bit of a connection there. I just sort of think that, like, after a week of arrest and everything, you would have known everything about what was going on there, that I probably would have felt like, oh, I should probably hold on to these.
Yeah. I mean, you never know how you're going to react with stuff like that, especially when it's somebody that you've grown up with your entire life and you literally share the same DNA. Like, who knows? The brain is a mysterious and complicated, I wanted to say trash pile again, but I feel like I've said that a lot.
No, it's quite appropriate. Kurt Vonnegut, in his book Time Quake, described it as a dog's breakfast, the brain.
Just yeah.
3 pounds of blood-soaked sponge.
That sounds right.
So I'll wrap up now that... after the arrest, a psychologist who examined Vincent Stanford after the murder said he showed a complete lack of remorse for the killing and said he seldom thinks about it at all. That he said, I hardly remember it. It was so long ago. That in handing down the sentence, Justice Hume said Stanford has developed an entrenched self-belief that he's defective. That says that his mental condition and his limitations cause him to fluctuate between despair for himself and unfulfilled expectations of others' treatment of him, which leads to entrenched anger and hatred. He's essentially locked into this eternally conflicted state. So as a result of his murder and other actions against Stephanie Scott, that he received 15 years jail for aggravated sexual assault, followed by a life sentence for murder.
Oh, I thought you were just going to say he only got 15 years. I was going to go ape shit, but he got a life. He got life as well. That's all right.
Yeah, after 15 years, he then has life.
Oh, yeah, good. So he's never getting out. Wonderful.
His brother served about 16 months for being an accessory to murder.
Mm-hmm.
And some people locally were quite angry about that, but I think that...
I mean, he wasn't, it's not like he was there.
Yeah, and being drawn into things the way he did, that I don't know what people would expect. That
people are going to be angry about it no matter what happened.
Yeah, and that's the thing, that no matter what happens, no one will be happy, but at least the guy that did it has gotten life. But yeah, it's just, it was such an odd, such a sad story, especially for Stephanie's family, but just everything about it, with how creepy this Vincent Stanford guy is, all the stuff that he looked up and his history before it, as well as being a week out from Stephanie's wedding and happening over Easter. I feel like if you pitched this idea as a movie or a novel, that people would knock it back for almost just being too cliche.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, that's crazy. So that's your hometown. That's insane. Thank you.
Yeah. My girlfriend came back with me, because my birthday's around that time as well. So usually go back then, it could be like my birthday, Easter. So she came back, and when the news got out that her mum actually rang her to make sure she was all right. It's like, it's just one woman a town over. It's not like there's a serial killer out there.
Yeah. Wow. That's insane. That's so close. Okay, well, I'm going to do the story of the Sodder children.
It already sounds ominous.
It's a hell of a last name, that's for sure. So like I said, my story is for all of December going to be Christmas themed, and this is the first one of those. So George Sodder, born Giorgio Sadu in Italy, 1895, immigrated to the US at 13 years old with only his older brother, who, once clearing immigration, left George in the US and went immediately back to Italy. He never spoke about why he moved. He never spoke about where his parents went. He never spoke about anything to do with his life before moving to the US. That was it. He was born in Italy and now he's in the US, and that's all that mattered. Eventually, George would marry another Italian immigrant, Jenny Cipriani. So he had like a bunch of different jobs and all that kind of stuff. Grew up, met Jenny, and then they got married. The couple eventually settled on the outskirts of Fayetteville, West Virginia. They built a large two-story timber home where they expanded their family to have 10 kids, which, like, I get it's the 1890s, but, or actually be the early 1900s, but fuck, 10 children is a lot.
You probably built the rooms on the house as they had kids as well.
Every time they found out she was pregnant, just add another room on. Yeah.
Yeah, that's something they used to do.
So the Sodders had their own business as a hauling, trucking sort of company. So they started with like soil and dirt and then ended up coal for local mines, stuff like that. They ended up becoming a really well-respected and successful family within like the middle-class community of Fayetteville. So in the community, George Sodder, as well as being a successful and, you know, well-renowned family man, he was known by his strong opinions. And he was not at all shy about them.
These like just real shit opinions as well.
something that would sometimes alienate and anger others around him. The main one he would get into tiffs about was his severe dislike of the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini. Which, fair.
Well, that one's actually aged well.
So he's a good dude. but Fayetteville at the time was populated by a lot of Italian-born citizens, and so he often ruffled feathers. Politics at the time, I guess it was sort of just on the cusp of World War II beginning, so everybody was quite tense about it, but he was somebody that was not afraid to sort of start an argument and make sure everybody knew his position. 1943, their youngest daughter Sylvia was born, and at the same time one of their sons was off to fight in World War II. 1994, Mussolini was deposed and executed, and this caused a lot of tension in the immigrant community, and George Sodder was not shy about expressing his glee.
It's these kids here that are the weird ones, is it? Is it his one?
I'm not giving you any spoilers. You go away.
All right. I just have to try and make a mental note of all 10 of these kids myself.
I do list them all at one point.
All right.
So October 1945, a few weird things happened concerning the Sodder family. First, they were visited by a traveling insurance salesman who, when George told him they weren't interested, traveling salesman who remains unnamed in all sources, warned his house would go up in smoke and his family would be destroyed, all because of the dirty remarks, that's in bunny rabbit air quotes, George had been making about Mussolini.
This is and I take it this guy wasn't like a fire alarm salesman.
No, like insurance.
Insurance, if he was selling like house insurance or something like that, it'd be almost like, well, of course he's going to make those claims, he's trying to get the sale. But this just seems like a bit of a front, doesn't it?
Well, especially because when George told him no, go away, he started yelling about the fact that George was against Mussolini, so that seems a bit personal.
How does the insurance salesman know this?
Yeah, exactly. November came around and another visitor, someone who was seeking employment or casual work on their farm, went around to the home and warned George that his fuse boxes would cause a fire someday, which to George didn't make any sense as he just had the house rewired with an electric stove and some new lights and the electric company had signed off on it all being safe.
Feels very... This again feels ominous. And
this is what's called foreshadowing.
Yeah, I'm getting a sense of that here.
Yeah. A week before Christmas, one of the older Sodder sons reported to his father that there had been a car idling by their home, specifically watching the children come home from school. So, Christmas Eve, 1945, the eldest Sodder daughter, Marion, came home from her shift at the local dime store with surprise new toys for three of her sisters, Martha, who was 12, Jenny Jr., who was 8, and Betty, who was 5. The little ones were so excited they were allowed to stay up late so they could enjoy some time with their new gifts. Two of the boys, Maurice, 14, and John, 9, also asked to stay up later. Their mother gave them permission with one catch. They had to remember to bring in the cows and feed the chickens before going to bed. Which, I just gotta say, I get that they're young and it's the early, you know, 1900s, but it's like 11 o'clock at night. Do the chickens really need to be fed at 11 p.m.? And why are the cows still outside?
Yeah, that sounds like real during the day chores. Like,
yeah.
if I get home from work and this is all done, you can stay up.
Yeah, it seemed really weird that at 11 o'clock at night she'd ask her, you know, 9-year-old and 14-year-old to do that. Anyway, so with the young one staying up, George and the two oldest boys, John 23 and George Jr. 16, already asleep, Mrs. Sodder took her youngest Sylvia, who is 2, to bed. I just listed the entire Sodder family.
I kept track of a couple of them.
It's
George
all right.
George Jr. and there's the youngest.
Sylvia. Two
go.
Out of 12. Well done. Okay. At 12:30 a.m. Christmas morning, the Sodder's phone rings and Jenny answers it. There's no mute, silent, because fuck no, I would not answer my phone at that time. The person on the other end was a woman asking for someone who did not live at the house. Jenny recalled hearing sounds of a Christmas Eve party in the background and the voice was not someone she recognized. Jenny tells the caller that she has the wrong number and then describes the woman as having a weird laugh as a response. Before going to bed, Jenny sees Marion, the eldest daughter, asleep on the couch with the lights still on and the curtains opened. Usually, before bed, the kids will turn off the lights and close the curtains. With only Marion on the couch, Jenny assumes the younger ones have gone to bed in their shared attic bedroom. That's where they all sleep. I lost my place, like, immediately. How does that happen?
I guess he didn't build the extra rooms on as the kids came in.
No, just shoved them all into the attic. Oh yeah, so she assumed they all went to their shared attic bedroom. She closes the curtains and turns off the lights herself, which mums do quite often.
Yeah, very, very, very matronly thing there. And that phone call, that you know, without you know any idea what happened next, that sounds like one of those testing calls you do, where to see if someone's home. And if they are, you just be like, oh, wrong number. But if you don't get an answer, you know that there's no one home.
It will just put so that in your pocket.
That's my conspiratorial brain already at work here.
So 1 a.m., this is half an hour after the phone call. Jenny wakes up when she hears a bang on the roof, like something landing and then rolling. She goes back to sleep. 1:30 a.m., Jenny wakes again. This time there's smoke. George's office is on fire, appearing as though it had started at the fuse box and telephone. Jenny wakes George and George gets the older boys up. George and Jenny begin frantically yelling for the younger children in the attic, but they can't get to them as the stairs to the attic area are already engulfed in flames. So Jenny, with Sylvia the baby in her arms, George and the two older boys, John and George Jr., as well as Marion, who is asleep on the couch, all escape the home. Standing outside of the burning home, efforts to rescue the younger children were underway. With no phone, Marion ran to their closest neighbour to call the fire department. A passerby who had seen the flames went to the tavern and also called the station, but neither of these attempts were able to even reach the operator. Eventually, the passerby or the neighbour, we're not 100% sure, did reach the fire department, and it was... There's a couple of reports there. It was either by using a phone elsewhere in the centre of the town or another... Few reports I saw said that the neighbors just went into town to find the fire chief.
This is very old timey, isn't it?
It really is.
Going to the neighbor's house, needing to call the operator, and then just having to, you know, get the fire chief out of bed in his in his night robe with his candle and probably like
yeah, one of those sleepy cap. So, George, who had escaped the house barefoot, rushed to find their ladder to try and reach the children, but it had somehow gone missing from its usual place. Without the ladder, George attempted to climb the wall and break open the window, causing himself injury in doing so. There was a water barrel that they had on the property, but December in West Virginia, the water inside had frozen solid. George's next idea was to back up his trucks from the business to the side of the house, climb them, and access the window, but neither of the two trucks would start despite being used earlier in the day on Christmas Eve and having no issues beforehand.
Hey, now, I'm starting to detect a pattern here. This is getting...
It's almost like it's on purpose.
Yeah, there's too much is going wrong here for it all to just happen.
Yeah.
Georgie was able to start his own business. He can catch a break every now and then. This is just too much.
So it would take 45 minutes before the Sodder home was nearly nothing but flames, smoke and ashes, and the family that had escaped was just standing outside watching it, nothing they could do. So where the fuck was the fire department? Well, apparently because of the war, the fact that it was Christmas Eve, the fire department of Fayetteville was so badly understaffed and poorly organized, they relied on whoever got the initial call to start a phone tree to call another firefighter, who then had to call another one, and so on and so forth.
Like a literal game of telephone.
Yeah, exactly. except with people's lives. So the chief firefighter, F.J. Morris, who was the only one at the station that night, had to wait for someone else to get him because the chief of the fire department couldn't drive the fucking fire truck. He didn't know how.
I thought it would at least be something like the chief was the only one with the keys, like even worse than that.
Yeah. It made me so mad when I read that. So the Sodder house goes up in flames, destroyed by about 2 a.m. It wouldn't be until between 7 and 8 a.m. Christmas morning that the fire department even got there. You want to guess how far away the firehouse was?
I reckon probably only a couple of k's down the road, really.
2.5 miles, so that's 4 kilometers.
God, just by that point, like...
You'd be able to see it.
Yeah, like, they just turn up by that point, like, for the sake of paperwork.
Yeah, so I've written here, Fire Chief McUseless, his name's Morris, but I'm going to call him McUseless from now on, had a cursory look through the now mostly cooled ashes of the home and reported to find nothing resembling the 5 children that would have been in the fire. Morris suggested the fire was hot enough to essentially cremate the children, which modern science tells us that that's bullshit and not at all possible. This is where I was saying in your story about how long it would take to, or how you'd burn a body. So it takes approximately 800 to 1,000 degrees Celsius at a continuous state to cremate a body and for at least 90 minutes at the hottest point. And that's continuously. Yeah. If you have a temperature fluctuation, it can take 3 to 4 hours.
So yeah, no just regular house fire, a bit of fuel, you know, like just old rafters would be enough for that.
Yeah, so, and I wrote here, something house fire simply cannot do, and even then there are usually bones still remaining. So it can, you know, get rid of mostly flesh and stuff like that, but bone is really hard. And even when you cremation, they will still have bone fragments and stuff during that. They just sort of don't include it in the ash. Sodders were instructed to leave the ruins while there was an investigation, but 4 days after, George and Jenny were so saddened by the sight that they bulldozed the remains of the home to build a memorial garden for their lost children. It's also reported that nothing was actually happening. Nothing was being investigated because it was holidays. So
they would have just maybe marked it down, as you were saying, as just a regular old house fire.
Yeah, exactly. So they bulldozed the home and started building a new home and a memorial garden. An inquest was held and the children's death and the fire was ruled an accident due to faulty wiring. Coincidentally, or not, in my opinion, on the inquest jury sat the same man who had threatened George about his home and his children in October.
Yeah, I guess you may not have it in the notes, but this wasn't the insurance salesman, was it?
It was.
Ah, he returns.
Yes, and the motherfucker's name is nowhere.
That just makes it even more suspicious.
Yeah. So the Sodders did not believe in the inquest findings whatsoever. They said if the fire was caused by faulty wiring, the home's Christmas light, which was still lit during the fire, would have had no power to them and they wouldn't have been on at all.
The lights were on in the lounge room around the time of the phone call.
Yeah, that was about an hour before the fire.
Yeah, I guess they'd be trying to say that, I guess it was as soon as the something went wrong with the wires that they'd lose power. But
yeah,
I'm no electrician, but things were working fine up until then.
Also, Jenny said as they were leaving the house and watching it burn, they could still see the lights on.
Yeah.
They also found the missing ladder down an embankment 75 feet or about 25 meters away from the home, a place where in no way would any of the Sodders left it. So it had been removed. They usually kept it leaning up against the side of the house. That's just where they had it for whatever reason. That's where they kept it. And it was essentially thrown away, far away enough from the house that if they were running around in the middle of the night looking for it, they wouldn't be able to see it.
And you tie that in with something like all the cars not working as well.
Yeah. One of the Sodder boys, I think it was John, did say that potentially in their panic they might have flooded the engines, but to do it twice on 2 vehicles is quite a lot, but it is possible that the cars may not have been tampered with, but we don't know for sure. Further investigation from the Sodders found that the house's phone line wasn't burnt through, but cut. A telephone repairman said the person who cut the line would have had to have climbed 5 metres or 14 feet up a pole and have a 2-foot reach to cut it. A local thief who was stealing rope and pulleys in the area had admitted to cutting the line, but he thought it was a power line, which, regardless, doesn't make any sense. You don't need to cut a power line to steal a block and tackle setup.
No. I just think that if you cut a power line, like, accidentally, that would probably just fucking kill you. Whereas telephone line, that's the one that's a bit more fine. And just that as well. The amount of effort to go up 5 meters and have to stretch out you know, stretch out your arm 2 feet to cut a wire, you'd have to know, you know, want to know what you're doing to do that.
Yeah, and also if he's saying that he cut it because he's trying to steal like that. So block and tackle is like a rope and pulley system to lift like heavy blocks of stone, hay, whatever it is. But if you were stealing those setups, why the fuck are you cutting electrical wires? Electrical wires don't look like rope.
A lot more Ocean's 11 shit there for a petty crime than
yeah, exactly. There's also no record of the man's identity, but Jenny Sodder is noted saying that if he had cut the power line, there's no way any of them would have made it out at all because they wouldn't have been able to see where they were going, because there was definitely power to the house.
Yeah, definitely power at the time. Yeah, so that's a point. It would have been just, you know, back in those days, it would have been completely dark otherwise, so they wouldn't have been able to see a thing.
Yeah, there's no light pollution then.
Yeah.
So Jenny and George also rebutted the idea that the children's bodies had been burnt up completely, as there were still easily recognizable appliances and furnishings throughout the home, even so far as some of the bed covers still identifiable.
They were in the attic, which is sort of like the highest part. So that's going to be the last bit that falls into the fire.
I don't know about the science of that, but I'm going to say sure.
It's going to spend the least of anything in the attic is going to spend the least amount of time burning.
Heat rises though.
Yeah. It starts from the bottom. It's got to get up there first. Or like, you know, if the place fell down, since that's the highest point.
Well, Jenny said that the fire looked like it had started in the office, which they lived. She said they went to bed upstairs, so that's on the second story. It started like in the middle.
Below it, pretty much.
Yeah, and if the attic staircase was already on fire and they were able to get downstairs and out, it means it started up the top.
Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was like, hold on. So Jenny even went so far as to do his experiments herself of burning animal bones, and she never once had a result of total consumption. There was always remains. Later, they would also find an eyewitness statement of a bus driver who had seen men throwing balls of fire at the house, which, why the fuck didn't you stop them? Months later, Sylvia would find a small green rubber ball in the nearby brush, and the family then believed that the fire had started on the roof caused by a projectile incendiary device, which had been the noise Jenny had heard the night before the fire, the thump and the roll.
That's what I was going to say, that we heard about the thing that went bump in the night. There's a, you know,
it's a not bit of a reindeers, sorry.
Crossover. Yeah. And just like with that you said that it, you know, heard something lean on the roof and roll, and yeah, just putting that all that together, like, oh yeah, you know, that's going to become something a bit spicy later.
Yeah, definitely. So the main prevailing theory that's floating around is that the children weren't at all killed, but taken.
Interesting.
Yeah, there were reports that a neighbor had seen the five little Sodders peering through the rear window of a vehicle driving away from the burning house. Another woman said she served them breakfast Christmas morning, where they got into a car with Florida plates. And there was a whole conspiracy with the fire chief fire chief McUseless, who said he had found a heart in the ashes and buried it in a box. Which, if you're trying to claim that bones aren't surviving, how the fuck is a heart going to survive?
Yeah, like that's a pretty meaty muscle, but that...
And also...
That could be the only thing you find?
Yeah, and at that point, how do you know that that's what it is? We have so many organs.
Like, when did he mention this to people? Because I think the parents would like to know if you think you've found their kid's heart.
Yeah, especially because they did like a cursory look over when they were searching the ashes, and he said that they didn't find anything. But then later he says he says in a confessional to his priest that he actually found a heart and he buried it in a box. Word spreads fast in a small town, and it eventually gets around. Obviously the dude wasn't a very good priest, because I thought that shit was meant to be private. And it gets back to the Sodders. They confront him and make him take them to the bowl. They dug it up. And it was actually found to be burnt beef liver. And Morris had said that he had buried the beef liver as a fake heart to convince the Sodders the kids were dead. Which I'd just like to say, what the fuck?
This is just the inconsistency here of whoever was out to get George. They're like, I'll burn his house down, but killing his kids, that's just too far. I would have thought that if you're going to commit to arson, then you're sort of like, well, once I set this house on fire, whatever happens, happens.
Yeah, I think the thing that I just keep getting hung up on is, With this fire chief, so he says he doesn't find anything, but he's like, no, the kids are dead, but I can't find anything and everything was burnt up. And then he goes and gets a beef liver and goes, I know, I'll pretend that this is a fleshy part of the remains that was burnt but not destroyed like all the other things I said they were, and bury it. And then I'll spread a rumor so that they would think that I did find something and that their kids are actually... There's just so many levels of convoluted nonsense in that story.
And yeah, because it's like already that there was a house fire and after that the kids were gone. That would usually be enough to convince people that the kids died in a house fire. Why do you need all this this archaic ritual to reinforce that point?
It's just so many extra steps. So many extra steps. So George Sodder actually, he refused to give up on finding his kids. He knew they weren't dead. He knew they were alive. He knew they were somewhere. He once drove to New York after seeing a child in the newspaper that looked like one of his daughters. His demands to see the girl were refused upon arriving at her school, which, again, I say fair. like, maybe contact them and just be like, hey, where'd you get your daughter from? Is she adopted or something? You know, like, I feel like there's... Just don't rock up at a child's school and demand to see a little girl. That's creepy. He even had personal correspondence with J. Edgar Hoover, who wrote, although I would like to be of service, the matter related appears to be of local character and does not come with the investigative jurisdiction of this bureau. If the local authorities requested the bureau's assistance, I would of course direct agents to assist. But the Fayetteville police and the fire department declined the help from the FBI.
So Hoover's a pretty complex figure himself. Who knows? The FBI may have been in on it.
Well, the FBI wanted to help, but they can't come in unless invited because there's not, it's not like it crossed state lines or anything like that. It's a local matter. So he's like, I can't do, and this is when it was just sort of starting up as well. He's like, I can't do shit unless they invite me in. And then the local police forces were like, no, we don't need them. There's nothing wrong. Nothing happened.
The Vampiric Bureau of Investigation.
Yeah, that one. So eventually some advanced forensic testing was done on an excavated area where they found human vertebra. But the age was determined to be 16 or 17, all the way up to maybe 22. But the eldest of the missing five was only 14 years old. The bone showed no signs of fire exposure either. They believed it had been tracked to the site perhaps from the garden materials. So it had come in from maybe like, I read something that there was like a quarry or like a digging site that was just kind of partially near an old graveyard. And they were using that material for garden beds and, you know, landfill stuff like that. So that's where they think that came from. But to have just been a couple of tiny traces of vertebra of a 22-year-old in a spot that doesn't really make sense. It's not related to the kids. So a lot of people are like, oh, but they found vertebra. It's like, well, technically, yes, but not really.
Yeah, there's a lot to vertebra. And just like that, that random bones just turning up in your potting mix that, you know, you can quite literally buy blood and bone from Bunnings. Like, granted, it's probably more from animals, but
yeah,
you know, when you got an old graveyard nearby, it's not unheard of.
Yeah, exactly. So the FBI did end up actually investigating, but only for 2 years, and they got nowhere. They spent 2 years chasing up fruitless leads, and they just ended up having to give up. The family put out reward offers, flyers, and billboards to try and get any information on the missing Sodder children. More information came in about the children as they were doing this. Martha was claimed to be held in a convent in Missouri. Lewis was telling people his true identity in a bar in Houston in 1967. They actually went and checked out the guy that was saying that he was Lewis Sodder in the bar. The guy had no recollection of saying that, and they just reckon that somebody just made it up.
Sounds like a bit of a specific thing to say otherwise, doesn't it? Don't know how big this case was, but to just be go around a bar telling someone you're some missing kid seems a bit too specific. So maybe he...
But also, like, if you knew that was your identity and you were, like, not really that far, I don't know anything about US geography, but, you know, like, if the news could get there, why would you not just go home? You know, that just seems like, crazy to me.
If the kids were alive, why wouldn't they be trying to bust out of wherever they were as soon as they could and just letting everybody know what happened?
If they were able to, for sure, yeah. They received a letter that year too, so in 1967, with an image of a man resembling Lewis. On the back was written, Lewis Sodder, I love brother Frankie, Illy boys, A90132. So the Sodders added this image to their billboard and flyers and even kept a copy above their fireplace. They didn't put any details about where it was postmarked from, though, just in case it was like a secret message and he was being held and they were trying to protect him. Because at this point, people were starting to think that the mafia, the Sicilian mafia, had something to do with it. And it had something to do with George's history when he left and his family's history, and that maybe the kids had been taken back to Italy and been kidnapped. And there's just so many things that flew around with this. George Sodder died in 1969. For the rest of her life, Jenny Sodder wore black in mourning and would tend her memorial garden. She died in 1989, and that same year the billboard came down from the property. As of April 2019, Sylvia Sodder Paxton was still alive and is the last remaining known member of the original family. And that is the tragic Christmas mystery of the disappearance of the Sodder children.
The thing that strikes me as weird is, yeah, like, he was talking shit about Mussolini, but, like, who was Georgie to anyone in the Italian government?
I don't know.
Why would anyone care?
I don't know. Unless there was, like, some powerful people that he just, like, offended. I don't know. It doesn't make sense. Like, the whole world was talking shit about him at that point. Like, it just seems very specific. Unless there was something deeper that he just never told anybody about. But it's just a whole bunch of mystery craziness.
1945, like, the war, wasn't going that well for anyone. Like, Italy would have switched sides by that point. Georgie would have been in the right. And I don't think anyone was a fan of Mussolini by that point.
It's just insane. Like, I really want to know why he immigrated to the US in the first place, essentially by himself as a small child, like, and the rest of his family stayed in Italy. It's just...
Griffith's full of Italian migrants, and a big part of it was sort of more just money and, you know, however many people could afford to go over at the time. But the strangest thing there is just the dog act of Georgie's brother...
just leaving him there.
Yeah, and then just going back. Like, I guess in your research, you didn't see any mention of his brother having complications with immigration.
No, they got through. They got everything I read, they got all the way through. As soon as they were sort of clear and out in the open, he turned around, went straight back through.
Yeah, that sounds like that he just yeeted on back home and left Georgie over there in the land of opportunity.
Yeah. But it's just there's just so many things that, like, is it coincidence? Is it insane? Like, I also couldn't find, I actually dug around for this for a little bit. I couldn't find if the chickens were fed.
Oh, like, if they'd done any of their chores.
I couldn't find if maybe the kids were outside and they went to, like, they all went to go and help feed the chickens and pull in the cows, whatever it was. And maybe then they saw the people that were about to set the house on fire. This is my theory. So the kids, the eldest has fallen asleep on the couch because she's been working all day. Fair enough. Go to sleep. You're good. They go out to feed the chickens and pull the cows in. I don't know how pulling cows in works, but I assume that they just bring them into a barn or something. And that's when they end up seeing whoever was about to throw these bombs or cutting wires in the house, whatever it is, to burn the house down. So they grab them, chuck them in their car, take them, and then, you know... put them in an orphanage or send them back to Italy if it is an Italian mafia thing, whatever. And then that's why the lights and the curtains and stuff weren't closed, because they never came back inside.
Mm. And being on the top level, you think there would have been some... Yeah, they would have been able to hear the kids. And, like, with what you were saying, the details of that night, doesn't really say when they last actually saw the kids.
No. And I couldn't find, like, much about, when the last time any of the kids were, like, seen together. I think Jenny said the last time she saw them was when she went to bed. Marion said that the last time she saw them was just before she fell asleep on the couch. But other than that, nobody heard anything of them. There was one point where John, the older brother, he said that he managed to see up in the attic to try and wake them up. But that was just in one... like, of the very first things he said before everything sort of happened. So that could have just been, like, him saying that to be like, I tried to wake them up and there was nothing I can do, because he felt guilty that he didn't go up there. But for the rest of his life, he said that, like, you know, we yelled up there and that was as much as we could do because it was already on fire. So I don't really know if he saw them or if he didn't. But the fact that there was no remains found whatsoever is just, crazy to me.
Yeah, and then it's the... If say they were in the house when the fire started, to to get, yeah, because what, it was about three or so kids that you know, allegedly survived, right? So that's about maybe six or so kids from an attic bedroom that you've got to get out of a burning house, you know, otherwise, or like even beforehand. So if they were in there, how do you get them out of there without everybody just immediately knowing what's going on?
Yeah, well, another thing that I think about is, so heat rises, right? Smoke travels in an upwards direction until it gets too heavy. There's nowhere for it to go, and then it falls to the floor. That's why in a fire you crawl along the floor, because that's going to be the best air. So it could have been that, so say the kids were in the attic, right? And they did die in the fire. The family screaming at them and trying to get them up, they could have been knocked out from smoke inhalation or already dead from smoke inhalation in the first place. You know,
that's the only other possibility.
If it was already engulfed in flames. So there's two options. Either it was already engulfed in flames, they were dead or passed out from smoke inhalation by the time Jenny woke up.
Or they may not have been there at all. It's like,
or they were taken from, I still don't think that, I think they must have been outside, because I don't care how tired you are, if somebody comes into your house and takes four kids from your lounge room where you're asleep on the couch, you're going to hear something.
Yeah, you're going to notice that.
Yeah, so I think that the kids were outside doing that final chore or whatever it was that they had to do when they got taken before the house was burnt down, or they were already dead upstairs from the smoke inhalation by the time that they woke up and discovered the fire. And then when they bulldozed the house, I mean, maybe they didn't search properly, you know,
based on everything else, feels entirely possible.
Yeah, and the bones were crushed or something like that when it all was bulldozed, whatever it was, and then it was just lost in the debris.
Yeah, because that's the only thing, that say if they did die from smoke inhalation, that there should have been some degree of remains as a result.
Yeah, a lot of the people say that the fire department wasn't that very well trained, and that because they, you know, bulldozed over, it was never properly, the wreckage was never properly looked through. Like, it was a pretty cursory sort of look over, very shallow sort of search that they did that on Christmas Day. So the bones could have been in there and just nobody ever found it.
And you could probably see a bit of a trend with that of a very untrained fire department, probably very untrained police department.
Fact that the fire chief can't drive the fire truck infuriates me.
It's a very, yeah, that's like sort of basic requirements, isn't it? Like, if you're a fire chief, you should
let him be chief without knowing how to drive the fire truck?
I must have just thought, like, yeah, it's a truck. It's like all other trucks out there. And then you get in and you're like, oh, no. There's so many more dials and switches in here.
Yeah. Look at all these extra buttons. Oh, man. But, yeah, so that's the Sodder children. That one, yeah, that's infuriating. And the threats and, you know, your children will be destroyed, and then the guy being like, oh, look, your fuse box is shitty, but it's really not. And then that's what they say that the fire was, is just the ladder. Man, so many, like, it was definitely on purpose. The fire was definitely on purpose, but what happened to the kids is such a mystery.
So many things just feel very premeditated.
Yeah.
And almost what then makes that more remarkable is that they got away with it. Usually, if someone plans something like that, they fuck it up spectacularly and everybody finds out.
Yeah, I mean, it must have just been, like, maybe just because it was so long ago, but, like, the levels of how deep that cover-up would have been if they were taken is just insane. And then the levels of, like, idiocy, of covering up idiocy because of, and the kids were dead, is just also insane. So either way, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, just that balance of, like, whoever did it were professionals, and then the people investigating it were fucking useless.
Yeah, basically, that's what it comes down to. But yeah, so that's the first of our Guestmas Christmas stories.
Yeah, I feel like we've hit a milestone.
Yes, we have. This has made me all happy. I'm having a good time. So is there anything you want to plug before we go, Tom?
Yeah, I'd say that mostly just you can check out my website, tombrazzo.com, and the other biggest thing after that is my YouTube channel. I was thinking of streaming a game after this, and I've got my Fringe Festival show on there, and I was going to upload some extra bits that I shot during the Fringe sessions. So, yeah, that's pretty much just about, like, Tom Brazzo on all social media. You can look me up there.
Awesome. If you see it on Instagram, Facebook, or you're just having a look in the episode notes on whatever you're listening to, you'll be able to find that there. Go and check Tom out, and thank you so much for listening, guys.
Thanks for having me on, Ash.
Of course. It was great. I had a good time. We will see you next week.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
This is Dad Obsessed.